It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. The economy may be starting to grow, but people are still losing jobs. A few firms, as a matter of policy, refused to lay off even a single employee. New Hampshire Public Radio's John Greenberg looks at a couple of them.
The Hypertherm factory sits hidden in the woods, not far from Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. Inside, in a testing room, a jet of superheated ionized gas slices smoothly through an inch of plate steel. Hypertherm is one of the world's top manufacturers of plasma cutting tools. Director of Operations Jim Miller says when the world is making big, heavy things, Hypertherm does quite well.
Maybe a shipbuilder, automotive manufacturing, anywhere where you see flat steel, you would see an application for our products.
Unfortunately, late last year, the making of ships and cars pretty much ground to a halt. Sales of cutting systems at Hypertherm dropped 50%. How many workers did the company lay off? None. It put them to work doing other things. Normally, Lindsay Grace works on the production floor. Now she rakes leaves and maintains the grounds.
In the beginning, I was really scared to lose my job, and now I've had the opportunity to just come and do something different to help the company out.
Hypertherm saves money by doing everything in-house that it possibly can. Plus, it puts workers into training or assigns them to teams to rejigger the production line. The goal is to emerge from recession in a better position to compete. Company founder and CEO Dick Couch sees no tension between doing well by the employees and doing well by the company.
Once you have a highly trained technical workforce, the last thing you want to do is lay them off. And this isn't altruism. It's good business.
Couch says if he were making T-shirts, this strategy would fail. High-end products, experienced workers, and guaranteed jobs are a winning combination. Very few firms fit this mold, but Hypertherm is not alone. The granddaddy of the no-layoff companies is Lincoln Electric in Cleveland, Ohio. The maker of welding systems has been around for well over 100 years. It's a global company with over $1 billion in sales. Lincoln Electric CEO John Stropke says people considering this model need to go into it with their eyes wide open.
This doesn't come without additional pressure and challenges for management. And I would say equally, it doesn't come without additional pressures and challenges for the workforce.
Managers give up the flexibility to hire and fire as they please. Workers give up a guaranteed paycheck. Profit sharing is a big part of the model. When business is good, pay goes up. When it goes down, so does your pay. At Lincoln Electric, the work week shrank to 32 hours. Labor journalist Frank Collar just finished a book about no-layoff companies. Collar says this model rubs organized labor the wrong way. They prefer a guaranteed income to a guaranteed job.
Union leaders were very, very suspicious of this. They saw this as a tool for exploitation. And there's no question that in some work environments it probably was.
But Collar says today, workers at these companies do very well. The typical Lincoln Electric assembler can make over $70,000. Jordan Siegel at the Harvard Business School says the American economy would benefit if more firms adopted this model of shared gain and shared sacrifice. He's been doing work in South Korea, where the recession had relatively little impact on unemployment.
There's been just a lot of this kind of shared sacrifice, people sharing some reductions in compensation in order to avoid layoffs.
If these firms, both overseas and at home, are so successful, why don't more companies jump on board? Siegel says mainly because this idea is too different. He hopes the recession prompts more executives to take off the blinders when it comes to the no-layoff option. For NPR News, I'm John Greenberg in Concord, New Hampshire.
The Obama administration soon will be awarding billions of dollars in education grants to help local school districts raise the bar on student achievement. In order to qualify for the money, schools may have to grade not only their students, but their teachers as well. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Speaking at a middle school in Madison, Wisconsin yesterday, President Obama said one of the most important factors in student success is the teacher in front of their classroom. That's why a system for identifying good teachers is one of the main requirements. For schools that want some of the more than $4 billion in challenge grants, the Education Department is preparing to award.
We've got to do a better job recruiting and preparing new teachers. We've got to do a better job of rewarding outstanding teachers. And I've got to be honest, we've got to do a better job of moving bad teachers out of the classroom once they've been given an opportunity to do it right.
As part of its grant-making process, the federal government is encouraging schools to collect a lot more information about how students perform during the year and to use that information as part of teachers' evaluation. U.S. Education Secretary Arne Duncan says student performance shouldn't be the only yardstick for judging teachers, but it should be part of the mix.
There are teachers every single year where the average child in their class is gaining 2 years of growth. Those teachers are the unsung heroes in our society. Shouldn't we know that? And the flip side of it, if you have teachers or schools where students are falling further and further behind each year, I think we need to know that as well.
Teachers' unions have traditionally been wary of any system that rewards or punishes teachers on the basis of students' test scores. Some states, including Wisconsin, have gone so far as to ban the practice. But in order to qualify for the federal grants, Wisconsin is preparing to change its law, with the blessing of State Teachers Union President Mary Bell.
We as professional educators give tests, write tests, and use tests all the time. It is a question of knowing what the test says and what it doesn't say, and what it measures and what it doesn't.
Mr. Obama cautioned that important as teachers are, students and parents also play a vital role. He mentioned how his own daughter had to knuckle down after a disappointing score of 73 on a recent sixth grade science test. With her parents' encouragement, Malia Obama redoubled her efforts. On her next test, she scored a 95. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
A white-haired man came by our studios the other day, sitting right in this room. He wore a dark suit, had a smile on his face. Wasn't much over 5 feet tall, though he is considered a giant in journalism. Harold Evans is 81. He's written a memoir of his life in British newspapers. As a teenager, he worked in a small city in England during World War II.
One of my first jobs was to knock on a door and get a photograph from the parents who'd lost their son in the fighting in World War II. And I'll never forget walking up and down the street. I did not want to knock on that door. I just simply didn't want to embarrass them, prey on their grief by saying, "Your son's been killed, give me a photograph." I finally had to sack myself, knowing that if I went back to the office I'd just started, I would be sacked. And I knocked on the door and they said, "Oh, come in, lad, have a cup of tea. Do you want the photograph of Steve?"
Harold Evans believes the family welcomed him because he came from the local paper. It was the kind of paper that made connections with the community. He thinks it's the kind of paper reporters could learn from today, whether they work for an old newspaper or a new website. Harold Evans went on to edit one of the leading papers in London, and he recalls that job in his book, My Paper Chase. What got you started when you were editor of the Sunday Times, pushing for stories about thalidomide, which many Americans will know or recall was a drug that was prescribed to pregnant women, which turned out to cause birth defects?
I looked at some photographs of a child without arms, no legs either, so I thought, well, how are they going to manage? So when I became editor of the Sunday Times, I thought, well, I must check how these children are doing. Well, I found that I wasn't allowed to check. Why? Because the Minister of Health had refused to have a public inquiry, the parents were forced to sue. And in English law, if you start a legal case, nobody is allowed to look into the facts, still less campaign about it.
You repeatedly published photos of children who had grown up or were growing up without arms, without legs, without both, and decided to publish even after your own lawyer, whom you write that you trust, said, "This is not wise. This will get you in trouble with the courts." How hard a decision was that?
It actually wasn't very difficult. Once I decided to do it, I thought, well, if the justice system will sanction this kind of treatment after 10 years, no compensation of any decent kind for these kids, if the courts will sanction that, well, there's something wrong enough, and if I go to prison because I'm challenging it, it will be such a manifest injustice, I'll live with it. I'd rather live with having tried to do something than having turned away because I was scared for my own carcass. So when I began the campaign, actually, of course, we got massive support from the readers, so I was merely, in a way, a vehicle for the popular will to express itself. But before the popular will could express itself, we had to do something which only a newspaper could do.
So what happened when you began publishing these stories in defiance of the law?
Well, the government jumped on me and took me to the High Court where I lost. Then I went to the Appeal Court and I won. And then they took me to the House of Lords and we lost. And then I decided to challenge them under the European Convention of Human Rights. So I flew in bumpy aircraft to Strasbourg where we presented our arguments. And I'll never forget going to the final verdict, and these judges came in their crimson robes, very, very dignified, and they went one by one. We find a breach of Article 12. We do not find a breach. We do find a breach. We don't find a breach. It was like this, like a game of ping pong.
So you're counting and as you're going along.
Our counting went along, and we won 13 to 11, which meant that one vote either side had been a stalemate.
That's a pretty close football game.
Yeah, that 13 to 11, however, imposed a duty on the British government to reform the laws so that free speech was possible for cases of manifest injustice.
I'd like to ask what happened to the thalidomide victims, because we did have a situation where the distributor in Britain was offering them some money. You felt not nearly enough. Then they raised the offer as the case went on. What happened after that?
Well, we did in the end get what everybody recognized or thought at the time was adequate compensation, a trust of £20 million, the money to be administered according to the needs of the children as they were there. Now, when I went back to Britain for my paper chase publication in the United Kingdom, they turned up at the Cheltenham Literary Festival and in London, and they told a very sad story, which was the money had helped enormously. But they are now inhabit bodies that are 25 years older than their chronological age, so they're breaking down, basically. I met one woman. The money enables her to have a caregiver for 30 hours a week. For the rest of the hours in a week, without legs and without arms, she's living alone, trying to turn the light on, trying to cook. So it seems to me that the government, which prescribed this terrible drug, should accept the moral and legal responsibility of dealing with the consequences. So we still have to campaign to get the... I feel like saying, hello, haven't you heard this one before?
Too bad you're not still editing a newspaper, I suppose.
Well, some people are glad I'm not editing a newspaper anymore.
Well, you do write in this memoir, you give it the subtitle, My Paper Chase, True Stories of Vanished Times. What is vanished?
Oh, for the whole technology, for a start, for instance. I mean, when I was growing up, there were no telephones in our office, no telephones in most houses, for instance. I typed on an Underwood typewriter with four carbon copies. A young reporter today or a writer today on it, they don't know they're born with the computer.
What has vanished editorially, if anything?
That's a more provocative question, because almost anything I say will sound like sour grapes. He would say that, wouldn't he, because he hasn't got a newspaper anymore, although I might get one day again. I think a certain commitment to the public good has vanished in the race for circulation. I think that is accentuated when you get newspapers taken over, as you have across America, by people who either borrow extensively to buy the paper or never had any interest in what real journalism is about in the first place. So the first thing they start doing is cutting editorial. So the kind of investigative journalism, which I think is the absolute essence, is in danger, and in fact in many places has vanished. We have to have this searchlight to know what the hell's going on. So when newspapers or TV neglect reporting, so you get chunks of opinion without any factual basis whatsoever, we're all going to suffer for it.
Harold Evans is the author of a memoir, My Paper Chase, True Stories of Vanished Times. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you.
And you can read an excerpt of that book at npr.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. After a series of setbacks, the field of gene therapy has taken an important step forward. A report out today describes work by researchers in France. They have successfully treated two young boys with a rare but fatal genetic disease. As NPR's Joe Palko reports, this news is good for patients with this particular disease and for the entire field of gene therapy.
Finding the gene that causes a disease is just the start in finding a treatment for that disease. No one knows that better than Patrick Oborg.
1993
is the year Oborg published a key paper describing the single gene defect that causes X-linked adrenal leukodystrophy, or ALD. It's a devastating neurological disease, incapacitating and ultimately fatal. It's the disease affecting the young boy in the movie Lorenzo's Oil. In the years after he isolated the gene, Patrick Oborg figured out how to repair it and began working on a way to put the repaired gene back into patients. Enter Amber and Rachel Saltzman. They are both mothers of children with ALD. They started a foundation called Stop ALD, committed to finding a treatment for the disease. When they heard about Oborg's interest in gene therapy, Amber Saltzman says she and her sister flew to Paris to meet with him. Not so much to ask for his help, their children were past the point where they could benefit from gene therapy, but to see how they could help him.
It's not that we in particular were gene therapy experts by any means. It's just I think we took this relentless, whatever it is, we will make it happen.
Saltzman says she and her sister put Oborg in contact with some American researchers who were developing a new technique for getting repaired genes into patients using something called a lentivirus. By 2006, Oborg was ready to try the new technique with ALD patients. And now, as he writes in the journal Science, he appears to have a successful treatment for the disease.
I use the term treated. I don't use the term cure. Treated. The disease has been arrested, not reversed, really.
But arresting the disease may be enough if the treatment is done before the disease progresses too far. David Williams of Children's Hospital Boston says one of the biggest hurdles facing would-be gene therapies is getting enough of the repaired gene into patients' cells. Williams says Oborg's approach seems to have cracked that problem.
Even though they have about 10% to 20% of the cells apparently carry the new gene, that's enough, it appears, to arrest the progression of the disease.
One of the other big problems facing gene therapy has been safety. Another French team succeeded in treating a different genetic disease, only to discover that the virus they used to deliver their gene therapy gave their patients leukemia. William says the new approach appears to have avoided that problem.
Having said that, these patients are still only 3 years or so out from their therapy, and so it's still possible that something could evolve, although there's no indication in the molecular analysis that it would evolve.
Other researchers are impressed with the French team's results.
Oh, I think it's going to change a lot.
Jude Samulski is director of the Gene Therapy Center at UNC, the University of North Carolina. He expects many people will want to try the approach on ALD patients.
Even here at UNC, we see a lot of these kids, and now that we know there's an approach that may work, we'll start proposing it. Because if they can't get a bone marrow transplant, they have nothing.
Bone marrow transplants have been shown to work with ALD patients, but the transplants are risky and frequently there's no donor available. David Williams of Children's Hospital Boston says the French results may mean gene therapy is finally coming of age.
When gene therapy started, there was a lot of predictions that this was going to revolutionize medicine, and it's been a long time to get it to actually work in humans.
If the treatment for ALD holds up, it might be the start of that revolution. Joe Palka, NPR News, Washington.
The new chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts is ready to help struggling arts programs around the country. Rocco Landisman has been called loquacious, combative, and Broadway's favorite cowboy. But the former theater producer is going way off Broadway now. He's going to find out how a tour of arts organizations plays in Peoria. NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg has more.
This one's on gold leaf and eggshell.
Rocco Landisman's office in the beautiful old post office building on Pennsylvania Avenue is filled with paintings by his father.
The title is Goodbye Lola, Goodbye.
A St. Louis cabaret theater owner with lots of hobbies. Son Rocco inherited Dad's theater DNA. He owns 5 theaters in New York and produced Angels in America, The Producers, Big River. Big switch from Mr. Broadway to Mr. Bureaucracy.
August 11th was my first day.
How you doing?
So far, so good. It's not boring.
Frustrating, though. He's used to running his own show, being the boss. When a Broadway biggie wants to get something done, it gets done.
Here, I want to do something, and there are 3 or 4 people who immediately tell me why I can't do it, And then if I still insist on doing it, well, that's going to take another 6 months. Mm-hmm. But I feel very engaged. It's exciting so far. It is.
Which brings us circuitously to Peoria, where brickbats will not be thrown at Rocco Landisman, despite his having said early in his brief NEA tenure, quote, "I don't know if there's a theater there, but I bet it's not as good as Steppenwolf or The Goodman." Those are two first-rate Chicago playhouses. Uh-oh. But Peoria wasn't mad. They just invited Rocco to come visit. So it is stop number one on his so-called Art Works tour. And he's pleased.
Peoria is not very far from where I grew up in St. Louis. My favorite restaurant, Steak and Shake, is there.
Steak and Shake is your favorite restaurant?
Chain of restaurants, yes. And it's my favorite place to eat.
Is it? What's it like that we would know?
I would call it very high-quality fast food served on china.
And Landisman knows there is also art in Peoria.
There's great art everywhere. Art can come from the most unpredictable places. And we're going to be going around the country and looking at what kind of art there is and how that can support what's going to be our program over the next few years.
The NEA budget will be $167 million next year. Landisman says more and more arts organizations are cropping up, even as audiences decline. So it's legitimate, he thinks, to ask if arts institutions are being overbuilt, and for him to go after more money, too. He is sure the arts have a real economic impact in America, creating jobs, bringing in money. But in this economy, Landisman says you can't go to the administration, Congress, foundations, hat in hand, and say this opera company, that mime group, that theater won't exist if we don't help right away.
I genuinely think the response will be, gee, that's a shame, that's too bad, but we have more important priorities on our plate right now than arts institutions. If, on the other hand, I can go to Congress and the administration and say the arts should be part of domestic policy, should be a part of coming out of this recession, should be a part of the revitalization of our communities and neighborhoods, then I think we have real traction in domestic policy, and I think we're talking a completely different conversation.
One of your predecessors, Bill Ivey, said, "The arts will always be an East Wing thing. Never West Wing." In other words, East, where the soft stuff is
right.
Done. So do you want to move it across?
Yes, we need to move this into the West Wing as well, into the place where they're making decisions about economic initiatives. We need to be at the table with the grown-ups. That means the West Wing.
Rocco Landisman. After Peoria, the chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts will travel to St. Louis, Memphis, Nashville, and Points West. The one-time Broadway producer seeing and declaring at each stop that art works. I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News.
Were you in New York on 9/11?
Yes. It was very important to get the theaters opened right away because in New York they were a symbol of tourism and activity. And we missed one night. The next night, the theaters were open and running, and I remember giving a curtain speech. It was early in the run of the producers. I think the fact that we were able to laugh that night and have, the producers, the funniest show ever made. So the fact that we were able to share some really hearty laughs was the most important thing we could do that night. I remember it like it was yesterday.
This is NPR News. We're going to hear new music now from a performer with a famous last name and a hauntingly familiar voice. NPR's Vince Pearson reports on the solo debut of the son of Paul Simon.
Harper Simon has recorded with other groups before, but this is his first attempt to carry a record. Pick a track. It's easy to hear where the man gets his voice.
Everyone seems so certain. Everyone knows who they are.
Some performers might be flattered to hear they sound like Paul Simon. Harper, now 37, sounds conflicted.
Is that true? Sometimes you hear people and they sound like their parents and it kind of makes you cringe.
They all got more friends than they can use. Except me, 'cause I'm a fool.
As a younger performer, Harper says he sought to avoid the comparison. Paul Simon played folk music. Harper got into punk.
I just didn't have the voice that doesn't carry over the loud, distorted guitars. So I had to go back to the acoustic guitar, because actually it suits my voice.
It's even money, you'd think it's funny, if I got a pie in the face.
Simon says the album is a tribute to rock records he admires from the 60s and 70s. Think Bob Dylan's Blonde on Blonde or the Byrds' Sweetheart of the Rodeo. And even recruited some of the same players.
The northern winds have found their home.
With help from a producer known for his work with Dylan and Johnny Cash, Simon booked a group of veteran Nashville session musicians. Harper's dad, Paul Simon, also helped write songs. Harper toured with Simon as a teen and even joined him on stage occasionally. But he says this was the first time the two ever really collaborated.
And I didn't intend to collaborate with him. I guess he got inspired and I had so many tracks, I was kind of swamped. So I was happy that someone was going to try to solve some problems for me. You know, what can I say? He's a good writer.
Harper Simon says he never thought it would take this long to find his voice. So maybe it's fitting that with this album, an album he made with help from his father and other early musical influences, he may have done just that. Vince Pearson, NPR News.